We're going to do Calvert Trail 5.
I repeat that Moor Hood, not Head, was our mission chief, and he had his wife and child out there and was a very respectable person, but he had to move amongst all these secret intelligence people, many of which were jealous of each other, and he had to move delicately and have a line of communication straight back to London. And I do not know what happened, but we felt we left rather under a cloud. But certainly I've been very pleased to receive messages, and I've been back to Australia, how much certainly the soldiers appreciated what our mission did. And our two warrant officers were very, very good examples of Britain. That's the Sergeant Major Peter Stafford and the Sergeant in Signals. And so they upheld the reputation of the British Army, you might say. I think later on, Australia developed, there was portions of Australia developed a sort of dislike of Britain. This was encouraged by the Americans when they arrived, and they said that one of the reasons was Churchill wanted to fight to the last Australian, you know, the usual jibe, that in the Middle East it was the Australians who did all the fighting, and there were no infantry divisions in the Middle East except the Australians and New Zealand. And this bad blood, I think there's always a certain amount of bad blood between Australia and New Zealand, brought about by a lot of Irish who had been fed up with our so-called behaviour in Ireland. There's also the jealousy of the Americans who used to stir it up. And it was sad, this. Their Prime Minister disliked flying, so he never came to Britain. He was an alcoholic, an ex-alcoholic. He'd got over it. But this made him frightened of flying. And the result is he only came to Britain end of 1944 or 45. I think it's a great pity that Churchill never went to Australia. They had rumours which I heard as late as 1970 when I had visited Australia. Oh, 70. As you were. 83 when I visited Australia. I was in Australia for 8 years in the 50s. They believed a story that Churchill had said, it doesn't matter about Australia, we can recover that in the peace treaty. And these were the sort of malign remarks being made in Australia, and I'm afraid a lot of these still persist. So when Churchill wanted an Australian division to land in Burma to save Rangoon, the Prime Minister disagreed. Prime Minister of Australia disagreed. Curtin. And it was due to all this bad blood which had been sown, which I think was tragic. You just stop me. I don't want to give the impression that the majority of Australians in any sort of war or battle like that would be pro the sovereign and pro-British, but this feeling, these rumours which have been spread, has upset the Australians no end, and it's still in existence. Now, for instance, I'll get back to this, the independent companies. There was a rumour going round that I heard this later, after the war, that they had been raised by the British to go and save Britain. In fact, they would be used in Britain if Britain was ever occupied. This was totally untrue. Our main role was to teach these independent companies so that they could operate against the Japanese. We had the Japanese war very, very much in mind. And I always thought we should have been thanked and been given some kudos for having thought about the defence of Australia long before Pearl Harbor. And we should have been given some credit for that. But I'm afraid we haven't got any credit. We got credit by saying how well we trained them and this, that and the other, but there's no country-to-country credit at all, which is very sad, I think. It's a pity, because it should go down in history. It should be in military history. It's unfortunate the operations in Timor, again, were rather belittled. General Blamey came back from the Middle East, and he, at that time, in the Middle East, there'd been a revulsion against commandos. And he came back, and both he and MacArthur, who'd taken over, felt that it was a sideshow. And so this independent companies who'd fought so well for 13 months in Timor were not given the praise and kudos they should have been. And other members of the independent companies who escaped, I know one man who had never been on the sea before, and he got a boat and collected a lot of these parties, and he escaped 6 months later and to reach Cairns. And all they said, "Where the hell have you been?" And he got no credit at all for what he had done. And I think that it was a pity that, although later on they did expand, they turned the whole of their cavalry division into independent companies or commandos, and they operated in New Guinea and in the islands right ahead of the regular forces. But this then it all got tied up between the jealousies between the Australian army and the American army and MacArthur. And I recommend that the best book about this is called Allies of a Kind. And I don't remember the author. He's a professor in Sussex University. And the Allies of a Kind are China, Britain, America and Australia, and how they all pulled against each other during the war. They had different aims, and he quotes some of the appalling signals which went between them and remarks made about each other. It's a book well worth studying and well worth reading, because if anybody who's interested in the history of that time, I think that's all I can say at the moment. I'm running out of... I would like to clarify one point. I would say that still now the average Australian soldier and civilian would be prepared to fight for the sovereign, would prefer to fight alongside the British than any other nation except possibly New Zealand. And there is this reservoir of loyalty, if you like to call it that, or certainly friendship with Britain. But it's sometimes eroded by smart-ass businessmen or ambitious people who want to make their own go, and especially, I regret to say, by the Americans. In the Far East, Britain and America have always been rivals, and for a long time the Americans thought that we were their main enemy, and I'm afraid that this still exists. I would like to just go straight back onto an incident in Australia, on which I touched on, but I think it would be right on consideration to enlarge on it a bit. This was the time, it must have been 2 or 3 months before we left in October 1941, when I was summoned to see the CGS, General Sturdee, and he had with him, I think it was General Robertson, and they gave me a letter to take to Colonel Moorhood, head of mission. And it was obviously something very serious, and I had to sign for it. And I went off, might have been earlier than that in the year, and I found with difficulty, I found where Moorhood was, and he said, look, you must hide me, possibly in your own flat or something. And then he explained. He said that what I had was a warrant for his arrest, this was at a time, as I mentioned, when the two parties in the Australian Parliament were exactly equal, and there was one man who could bring down the government. I reiterate that Moorhood was called Colonel, but had been in MI6 and never had anything to do with the army, and so was under suspicion. The Australian, through the army sources, had been in touch with our own Chief Imperial General Staff, and who had given permission for them to put Moorhood under arrest. Moorhood said to me, he said, if you can hold me for 24 hours, everything will be sorted out, because the government will fall, and the new government under Curtin knows all about us, and the matter will be cleared up. So I hid Moorhood. His wife and child remained at his flat, and I went back to see General Sturdee and Robertson, whom I liked, and as ordered by Moorhood, I said that I couldn't find him, and that I returned the letter. Now, it was my impression that they knew that I was lying, and they expected it. They expected, on a question of loyalties, I would stick to Moorhood. And I knew they knew I was lying, and I felt very awkward about it. And they said, right, that's what we expected, and thank you very much, Captain Calvert. And I pushed off, very uneasy. That following day, it was announced in all the papers that the government had fallen, and the new government was being taken up by Curtin, and Moorhood came out, and I never heard any more about this affair, except when I saw, as I mentioned, an intelligence officer in Darwin, I was still very worried as to where my loyalties lay and as to whether Morford was okay or was off his head. I remember the name now of that intelligence officer. His name was Commander Drage, D-R-A-G-E, and he had been, I think, head of intelligence in China. I have met him since in Kensington, and he's now dead. He also remembered this occasion, and when I told him what the situation was. He will be remembered by the fact he has written some books, including One Arm Sutton, Two Gun Cohen, and other books of that nature after he had retired. I also, in a visit to Australia in about 1984, I was taken to, especially, and met the ADC to General Sturdee. I think he's either ADC or PA at the time I speak. He was an elderly man then, in 1984, and he remembered all this, and he said to me, well, you can't blame us, because we couldn't understand about Morehead, and we didn't know that he'd had no military knowledge, and some of the things he told us seemed to be right round the bend. He said, we realize now what the situation was, but it is really Britain's fault for not making it, due to secrecy, not making it clear about the formation of SOE and your own position in that. So, to a large extent, my story was corroborated by this PA, and I don't remember his name. I can find out his name because I know who introduced me. That's all on that particular subject.
So, what stage in 1941 are we at now, when you left Australia to go to Burma?
It is about October 1941. That is about 3 months to Pearl Harbor. I had been seen. Is this being recorded?
Yes.
I had been seen by Colonel Meade, I remember his name, who had visited us in Wilson's Promontory, and he had come out on purpose to find out if I was a suitable person to be commandant of the proposed guerrilla warfare school in Maimu for Mission 204 to China. I, in Rangoon, about this time, I met the commander-in-chief who had been, I'm going to forget his name, who had been related to me by marriage, and all the top people. But I will come back to that later. Mission 204 had been formed, again, on Churchill's directive to try and maintain the Chiang Kai-shek's guerrilla activity in China. At this time in China, the Japanese had pretty well gone wherever they wanted, but there were vast areas of which they hadn't got complete control. Their method of control was by terrorism. If anybody committed a, blew up a bridge or something, they would kill 100, 200 or more of the inhabitants nearby. The actual the actual orders or directives for the mission, which I seem to remember were written down, were that our job was to raise the standards of efficiency of the Chinese guerrillas from 1% to 2%, thus tying up another 100,000 Japanese in China. British policy was to get the Japanese entangled in the continent of China so that they wouldn't have the strength to make naval acquisitions of British possessions all over the Pacific and Southeast Asia. In Japan, there was a naval party and an army party, and so they wanted, for our benefit, for the army party to take precedence, and for the so not so much money was spent on the navy party. What Britain was afraid of at that time was the Japanese joining the Axis, if they were members of the Axis, but joining it actively, and attacking our possessions and possibly the Dutch possessions without any declaration of war against the Americans. So our policy was to embroil the Japanese with the Americans, if possible. Mission 204 was to train cadres of officers and NCOs in school in Burma, sited in Burma, and so that each cadre would go into China and form their own guerrilla schools in the different parts of occupied China to improve the activities of the guerrillas. We could also supply them with explosives and booby traps and time charges and other methods which they may not have possession of. I ought to say now that the Chinese were masters of the art of booby traps and deception and everything else. In fact, the phrase "a Chinese attack," which carried out in the 1914-18 war, was an attack by cardboard figureheads to draw the enemy's fire, and the Chinese, in their wars for the last 2,000 years, had used deception and all forms of deceit much more than the Western nations ever had. The Guerrilla Warfare School in Maymyo, M-A-Y-M-Y-O, had already been set up, and it had been given the cover name of Bush Warfare, so that people thought we were training people how to fight in the jungle. Of course, in the areas in which these carders would fight, there was no jungle at all, so that we did not train these carders for jungle fighting. However, the aura of being commandant of Bush Warfare School landed on me, and I was supposed to be the expert on jungle warfare from there on. Now, these carders, whoever was in charge in London, thought that China was obviously the biggest theatre of operations where guerrilla warfare could be used, because it was in action. And so numbers of officers and NCOs from different parts of the Commonwealth were drawn to Maymyo, and many of them had guerrilla experience elsewhere. And they were a very erudite but mixed a bunch of officers, many who'd been in MI6 or in other similar establishments in different parts of the world. I will say they all got on well with each other and respected each other's achievements. I remained a major. I wasn't made a lieutenant colonel, so I had some little difficulty in being commandant of a school where the top people were mostly given lieutenant colonel rank.
Was there much to be learnt from the way in which the Japanese had used the jungle already in Southeast Asia?
No, because the proposed areas of operations in China, there was no jungle whatsoever. There's no jungle whatsoever in China except adjoining what was then Indochina and a certain little amount in Yunnan. But the rest of China is, except for bleak mountain ranges and deserts, is made up of agricultural land, mostly rice paddies in the south and wheat fields in the north. And it's there is cover with a certain amount of trees and afforestations, but there's no jungle, there's no rain